session number 23433, Reel 1.
Mr. Jeff Kirk, Reel 1.
I'm Jeffrey Kirk. I was born at 16 Castlewayne, Hamworth, Feltham, Middlesex, on the 7th of August 1923. Beautiful summer day, my mother said it was. I went to the local school, which is the Hamworth Park Road School. There was only about 350 pupils in the whole school, including the junior and the senior school, until about 1935, when they started developing the whole area. And then they built a new school called Oriel School. It was named after Oriel, the man who invented the Oriel window at Oxford. And we went there in 1935. From there, I sat an exam and I went to Twickenham Technical College. I joined Twickenham Technical College in the September 1937. And I stayed there until I left in 1940. But from September till January, we didn't go to school because they'd evacuated Ferns because of the war and had taken over the school. Then we went back and we used to go part-time. I then went to work for George Godfrey's for a short time, and then I went to work for Champion Sparking Plugs. Following that, I went to work for W.E. Sykes, who were gear machine manufacturers. In fact, they used to produce the fastest machine and produce the fastest tank sprockets in the country. And they could also produce the tank rings, cut the gears on the tank rings. They didn't actually produce the tank sprockets or the rings. They were supplied by the armament people, and all we used to do is cut the gears or the teeth on the sprockets.
Could you just go back to your schooling? Did you play any sport at school?
The council school. We did very little of that sort of line. We did woodwork, I think, one class of woodwork. We didn't play a lot of sport, but I did play rugby at Twickenham Technical College. That was their main game there. And cricket, I used to play cricket for them in the summer and rugby in the winter. I then didn't play any sport at all then, because the war came along and there was no time for sport, until I joined the army. Now, when I joined the army, they asked anybody play rugby, so I said yes. Well, I played in the knock-up game, really, and most of them appeared to be rugby league players, and they didn't appear to know the gentleman rules of rugby union. And I always remember the left hooker, I was playing hook at the time, but the left prop, he jumped on me, you know, very viciously, and carved my leg open with his studs. So when we went into the scrum next time, I said to my two props, swing me, and I promptly kicked him straight underneath the knee when their side collapsed. And he said, look at my knee, and I turned around and said, look at my leg, and the game settled down after that. After the war, I did do running for the Buffs. I was captain of the 3 mile team, and I also ran in the mile team. I've got 2 medals that I'm issued by the Buffs. That was at Rottenburg, and then I ran in the brigade sports, and we won the 3 mile team race there. I then, later on after the war, when they broke an air regiment up and I got sent to the Royal Scots Greys and they asked for rugby players, I joined them. It was a divisional trial tonight, and I had my leg smashed there, and I spent 4 months in hospital, and came home on the... I was in the 21st British General in Hamburg first, and then I came home on the hospital ship Atlantis. I then went to Lincoln Military Hospital. And then I got transferred home, near home. First of all, they said, does anybody want to go near home? Well, knowing the army, if you said you want to go to London, they say Glasgow. If you said you want to Glasgow, they say Cornwall. So nobody volunteered. I had to go and see the matron once. She said, you put your name on the board for thing. I said, I don't want to go to Scotland. She said, what do you mean? I said, well, no, in the army. I said, if I put London, they'll say Scotland. They, oh, no. So the following day, the MO came in and said, look, I've got to clear the ward. He said, I'll put your name down. Where you want to go? I said, I'll post you. So I said, for West Middlesex Hospital, which I knew, but they sent me to Ashford in Middlesex Hospital, where I spent another 2.5 months. I then went to the convalescent depot, which was in Richmond Park, which eventually became the home for the Olympic Games in 1948. And there I got on all right, but I couldn't hop. I could do anything. I could walk, I could sort of semi-run, but not properly. I could climb ropes, and then, but I couldn't hop. And I kept complaining about this because I was waiting for my demot. And I used to stand on the end of the bed, struggling to try and hop, and I couldn't get an inch off the ground. Well, Monday was grading day, where they gave you a grade for all the exercise, and they had this new young officer there. So he said, what's the matter with you? I said, I can't hop. He said, what do you think that is? I said, what I want is this electrical treatment. I hadn't got a clue what the electrical treatment was, but I'd heard about it. So I said, do you think that'd do it? Almost. Yes, definitely. That's the answer. So I said, I'll put you down for 12 seconds a day. I said, that's no good to me. Put me down for 3 hours. I said, I want to get out. Then. No, he said. So I went down the gym, and they got a black box, in actual fact, in which a black tube is passed, and two leads come off it. The physiotherapist massaged my leg, built up two muscles, taped the pads on there, and he said, wait a minute, I've got to go and get a stopwatch. I said, what on earth for? He said, 12 seconds. I said, don't talk now. He said, 12 seconds. So anyway, as you pushed the bar into this box, so all your muscles talked, and up came your leg. So after, you know, he then did the other two sets of muscles in my thigh, and that night I could hop a little bit, and I had one more session. I started hopping. Now I think my problem was, it was not physical, it was mental, that I was on my toes when I smashed my leg, and something in my brain was saying, don't get on your toes, you'll smash your leg. And that electrical treatment overcome, I feel, my mental problem, not which was really affecting my physics.
At the time when there was talk about war, what was it like in your family? Did your father and mother talk about the outbreak of war coming?
My father took it very seriously. Like, you know, I don't know if it talked about, but I always remember when the war was started on the Sunday, my father dug up the lawn. I said, you're destroying the lawn. He said, you've never been hungry, boy. He said, there'd be potatoes in there, right, and vegetables, eh? And then he was evacuated down to Bournemouth with a firm. We evacuated down there. My sister was in the Air Ministry. She was sent up to Harrogate to look after refugees, funny enough, right? And then in the March, that mean March 40, my brother joined the Air Force. But the day the war broke out, I was a messenger in the Scouts. We'd been on training, you know, gas course, like, and to become messengers. All the Scouts became messengers. And I was told to go and warn them all. And this was on the Sunday the 3rd, see? And I went round and told them all, you know, well, they all got a report to Meeson, his name was, that's right, he was the chief warden of Hamworth, right? And I was riding my bike down the Hounslow Road outside the oil school where I went to, just as the sirens went off, right? So I carried on riding and went down, went in his house, and when I knocked on his door, he dragged me inside. He said, come inside. He said, there's air raids up. And I said, well, no, I haven't seen the airplanes, right? And then, of course, after a bit, it was all quiet. But in his hallway was actually reinforced with big timbers, because there was no ARP post running, and that was the ARP post, and that's the reason it was all bulks of timbers along the ceiling and up the walls. We did eventually get some. They turned what they call the mount at Hamworth into a refuge centre. And what it was the old ice house, the Hamworth house, and they cleared it all out and turned it into a refuge centre, like a chief warden post. But of course, I didn't have a lot to do with this because I was at school, and then as soon as I left school, I was working. Well, when we were working at Champions, I was working from 8 in the morning till 8:45 at night, 30 and then 15:45 at tea, 7 days a week, because we were producing, we had to produce 30,000 sparking plugs for Spitfires every day or every week now, but I know they were figured, sticks in my mind, it was 30,000. And then they put me on, I was doing a setting, I set up this little machine which was producing mine rivets. What they did, I don't know, but the chute that they came off is an automatic lathe. The chute they came off wasn't working properly. So I put my hand in to grab one. Unfortunately, the parting tool index round and went straight through my thumb and turned all the metal up inside my thumb. I was then taken to West Middlesex Hospital. I couldn't do anything because I wasn't 16, I suppose. Only 16 or 18. They had to have my mother's signature before they could operate on me. And she came on there, and then they had one operation. They took most of the metal out, and then I had to go down there on the Sunday for another operation. But when I was in there, on the Monday, I was feeling fine because they had to wake me up for my meals and wake me up for the operation, and I didn't get any dinner because it was the operation was 2 o'clock on a Sunday afternoon. And then when I came, the doctor came around 11 o'clock on a Monday morning. He said, "Is there anything wrong with you?" So I said, "No." I said, "I feel as best as I've felt." He said, "You did nothing but sleep here, then." So I said, "I've been working from 8 in the morning to 8:45 at night for the last 6 weeks, and I'm now recovered, like, I feel fine." He said, "Why you work all those hours?" I said, "Well, they wanted the things." I said, "There was no alternative." Then in the June, wasn't it? They formed the LDV, like they applied for volunteers, and all the men at work, they all went down to Staines Police Station, and we had to sign a form saying we're over 17. Like, I was only 16 still at the time, right? And they were signed the form, and then we were all given an armband with LDV on it, like a lot of defence volunteers.
How did you feel about that? Did you feel proud?
Well, I don't know that I felt proud. I felt it was a job that had to be done. Like, this was my feeling throughout the war, really. It was an essential job. It's a job. Nobody wanted to do it, but it had to be done. There was no doubts in my mind about it, right? That it's a job that had to be done. And this is what annoys me about half the problem today. Am I allowed to talk about that?
Yes.
Yeah, right. That they talk about, the poor refugees this and the poor refugees that. And the asylum seekers this and the asylum seekers. Supposing, take the situation. They all say, well, they're getting this treatment. Supposing any British soldier, or all the British soldiers, have said, we're not going up the front line, we might get killed. Well, where would we have got to now? And this is what I think annoys all us old soldiers. Like, they've come here. We fought a war for freedom, for freedom of speech. Half our freedom's taken away. You can't say what you want. You have to watch your P's and Q's all the time. And this is what annoys all the old soldiers. And to my mind, this is why the government is trying to get rid of us old soldiers, because we say we fought for freedom, and this is our rights.
Is that how you feel?
That's how I feel. Yes. That I fought for freedom, and to me, can I go on about the Runnymede Trust, right? The Runnymede Trust, now they produced a document for which they got paid £351,000 to say that the British were, racist, looking at the names on the list, it didn't look like any of them were English. And I wondered how many had actually fought for freedom. It looked to me, it looked as though they'd all run away and come over here for a safe haven. And it's us who made the safe haven. And that's what they said, that the British were intolerant. And I wrote to the Telegraph and I said, yes, the British are intolerant against injustice, unfairness, wrongs and everything. I said, and the people of Europe should be thankful that the British are intolerant, because it was their intolerance against the German attack on Poland that started the war and eventually gave the world freedom. And now they talk about freedom. I said the Runnymede Trust, they're besmirching the name of Runnymede Trust. I said, if they go up to Runnymede, there's a monument there to the Air Force for the 20,000 airmen who've got no known graves fighting for freedom. And if they believe in freedom, they're free to go. Why don't they go now? And that's what I wrote to the papers about, the Telegraph. But the Telegraph never published any of my thing. I've never had anything published by it. And where have I got to go to now?
If you could talk a little bit about your work.
Oh.
When you first went. The LDV.
Local defence volunteers. Well, that was it was all extra to your work. You didn't think when you finished at 8:45 at night, then you reported to a room, and that was the guard room, right? I was armed. Up in my loft was an old rifle that had always been there, right? Which was a Martin Henry single shot thing. I had no ammunition, right, but at least I got a rifle, right, and I was one up from everybody else. Well, when I left Champions Park Place, when I left there, I joined Hamworth Home Guard, which in the 2nd Battalion, Middlesex there. I was then put in the intelligence section. Now, the intelligence section's job was to go out and look at areas for the location of guns, you know, where they could put machine guns and that, where the enemy might land. Our main job was to call out all the other they were Home Guard by then, people, you know, to report to the headquarters. And you had a little card with a photograph on it, you know, calling upon the army and the police to give us all the assistance that we required. Well, in actual fact, in our intelligence section was Fifth Columnist. Now, they knew he was there, see? And because when we used to go out, you always went out in pairs, like, and then you used to report back to the intelligence officer, and he used to give you a report, and you're both there. Then he'd call you in and say, what did he talk about? What did he look at, eh? And I queried, why don't they pick him up? He said, but we know he's there. If we pick him up, then they may replace him with somebody else. All the time they got there. Now this fellow was quite, Bebley's name was, he was quite intelligent, because his name in Chinese was Bo Defo. They didn't say Bedford, they said Bo Defo. And he started teaching me Chinese. Well, not Chinese as such, because Mandarin, he says, is the language to learn. Because every head man in every village in China has to be able to speak and write Mandarin. So that this is the way that the emperor communicated and kept everybody under control, because the head man knew it. And he could speak Italian and German as well, right? But I did see one of the fellow Dennis Selman, near the end of the war, came home on leave, right? And I just happened to bump into him, and he said, oh, they picked him up in 1943, like, you know. No, they knew he was there, and I suppose the invasion scare was over then, and that was it.
So after you received, you volunteered, didn't you? You volunteered for the army.
Yeah, I volunteered, yeah.
Would you like to talk about that?
What about, do you want the bit about when I, how I had with the, in the works?
Yes, I think that would be worth putting on.
Oh, right, okay. Well, let's put it
like this way. In summary.
Yeah. I joined the army over 6 months an hour. I've been made in charge of the night inspection, and things had gone wrong on one machine. I went to sort it all out. I asked the manager to sign for it, and he refused to sign for it, so I had to sign for it so that the process could carry on. I was in charge of the inspection department at night, and it was my job to inspect, basically to say whether it was right or wrong, not to do this, but until I'd signed for it, they couldn't carry on. And then in the morning I saw Percy Gearing, the manager, and asked him about my rise, and he said, how much do you want? I said, if I've got to do the night manager's job, I might not have any money. So he said, that you'll get nothing. So I came home, had my breakfast, jumped on the 111 the bus, went to Hounslow East to Acton, walked up the Horn Lane to the recruiting office, and I went in and I saw the National Service officer. And he said to me, the first thing he said, are your firm will it release you? I said, no, but not to go to another firm, but to join the army. So he tried phoning them, which I thought I might as well get up and walk out the door, like, and I know what they're going to say. Anyway, they couldn't get through. He said, they're engaged. So he said, sit over there. And I sat over there, and he interviewed other people, like, and after about half an hour, he had another go, and he's still engaged. He said, I suppose it'll be all right. He signed the form. I then did all my intelligence tests, had my physical, everything, signed the papers, got in the army. I actually received a shilling in my left hand, and I held the Bible up in my right hand, and I was sworn in as a member, now for the embodiment of the Territorial Army. And then I joined the army at Beverley in Yorkshire, and that was... everybody got the base of the infantry training, like you did all the training. Unfortunately, I got vaccine fever there, so I got taken in the cadet reception there. Well, the cadet reception was a big old three-story house, and I reported sick. Like, well, what actually happened was in the night I woke up with severe cramp in the stomach, and luckily we were on these little low bunks, and I could reach up and kept shaking the bunk because my stomach muscles were so tight I couldn't even breathe. Anyway, he kept shouting out, shut up, shut up. And the room corporal then gets up, then I'm spluttering away, and he goes and gets the MO. The MO, I think, then gave me, it must have been a nice word, morphine or something, relaxed me, and said that we pulled sick in the morning. Okay? Well, the sergeant came round. Oh, no, he said, the officer said, stay in bed and I'll send an ambulance for you in the morning. The sergeant came round, he said, anybody for sick? I said, me. He said, go over my bunk and report sick. I said, well, the officer said, I've got to stay in bed. He said, if you don't go over there and report sick, you're not sick. Now, I went over and reported sick and got back in bed. I then got taken to this casualty reception station, and we took up right up the top of the thing. And at the time, I couldn't even swallow my own spittle; the pain was so great. And then we went in this room, and it's like a small room, and there was five beds in there, six beds, and all there was room for a card table stuck in the middle between the beds. And we all got in the bed. Well. Some of the fellas were up, like, and the MO came round later on, and he said to one pair out of his, not too bad, sir. How do you feel? Not too bad. Not too bad. Okay, you three, discharged. Eh? So that's, and he came along to me, he said, what's the matter? And he just grabbed hold of it, and if I had the strength, I would have killed him. And anyway, that was it. Those three fellas disappeared. The next thing we knew was, there was somebody at the door. They went, one of the fellows was up, went to open the door, said, don't you dare open that door. And what they were doing, they were putting a harassment statement on the door, because the three fellows who pushed them in discharged from this country had got diphtheria. They reported sick as soon as they got home, and they got diphtheria. And what, of course, the army were terrified then, so they locked us up in this room. When the meal time came, they used to take all the way from the door, push the five plates on the floor, like, shut the door and put the bolt back on. Well, of course, the system broke down, really, because the ATS girls used to drive the ambulance by joining all the straps, because when you report sick, you all take your small kit with you, you know, a small pack which has one long strap. So we tied all the straps together, got one of the bags, put a few pennies in it, like, and the girls went off and got us some chips, and we hauled it all up and had the chips, like. And then I went back then to, the initial training wing, I think they call it, you know, went back there, and like, they put me in what they call the odds and sods platoon, and I had all the, I suppose they hadn't finished their course, or, you know, like me, they. And then I went to Catterick, and we became a gunner operator, like you do 7 weeks wireless and 6 weeks gunnery. Now they talk about intensity. Well, what you've got to remember is that in those days nobody knew the phonetic alphabet. in the phonetic alphabet, Abel Baker Charlie Dog, I don't know what they call it now, anyway. So not only did you have to learn Morse, which I suppose in some ways I was lucky because I'd done a bit with the Scout, right? You had to learn Morse, you had to learn all the phonetic alphabet, all the procedure, the Morse procedure, all the ins and outs, fault finding with a 19 set. It was an absolutely intense thing. And we used to practice sitting around in a big room with maps, and on the map you had a little bit of paper with your call sign on it and various other call signs, and then you used to have to report over it, almost like you were on the move, like you were sitting in a classroom pushing bits of paper around. Well, of course, to be a fiddler, you've got to be really expert in your job. So we used to go out on schemes in a little truck called PU, like a little 8-horsepower thing it was, and he used to have two of you in the back, like with a bunk radio set. Well, of course, Scotch Corner was a big cafe. Well, if you went to the big cafe, one person could sit in there with his bit of paper on the thing, and all the trucks were lined up, and he used to say, hello there, and all you had to watch was that if there was a hill between you and Capri, then you turned the set of net a bit, like, because that made the signal weaker. They looked, oh yeah, no. And we were pushing these rounds, so you were sitting in the warm of a cafe instead of sitting freezing in the back of a truck. And then we went out in the firing range. Did your 6 weeks gunnery, right? Which you took in practically every gun, I suppose, the British Army was there. You did your pistol, Sten gun, Tommy gun, rifle, Bren gun. 0.3 Browning, 0.5 Browning, the 2-pounder, because that's what the church would have on the 2-pounder, the 6-pounder. Then we went on to the Sherman 75mm, like that. Right at the end of the course, they did introduce, I think it was a 20mm Hispana. Because the anti-aircraft tanks had these two 20mm cannons on them. And then we went from there, to Albana Castle, where we did, I suppose, more extensive training and more schemes. Right. And
when you say extensive, in what way?
You fired more rounds there than you'd ever fired in your life. Like, you know.
How many in your group?
When we were in Barnard Castle, you used to go out in the range, there were all five in each tank, like, so that the drivers, every trade was getting its training in a position it was going to be in. I think we did most of our gunnery on Sherman, because the Americans were supplying the 75mm ammunition, which I suppose was more plentiful than the British 6-pounder ammunition. Because it was a marvellous gun, you see. On the Sherman, they tipped the breech sideways. Instead of being up and down, it went to the side, where you could stand on there, you could turn round, the ready ammunition bay was all round the perimeter of the turret. So you just bent down, picked up a gun, and you wore a glove on your hand, and you punched the thing in, and if you threw your hand away, if the gunner had his foot on the thing, it just went bang. So one time we did manage at one time, I don't know what the range was, about 2,000 yards, to get three shots in the air at one time, like, you know. And then we went from there, I went to Ashford in Kent. I was back on the Churchills, that's the 141 RAC in the bus, like, went on to Churchills, and then in the March they introduced the flamethrower, which was another course. You had to go up and hide a flame gun and know how to load it up or charge it up.
Just going back to Barnard Castle, is that where you first started on the tanks?
No. Catrick. The original tank we started on was let's see now. It had a hydraulic power traverse. Cromwell or. Valentine. It was a Valentine, that's right. And it had a hydraulic power trellis. Now, when we went to Churchill's, they had electric ones, and there was a doubt in our mind, supposing a fuse blows, supposing this, because we were brought up with the hydraulic power trellis on the Valentine, and supposed you had faith in it. And all of a sudden, they introduced a new system of having an electrical power trellis, and supposing a fuse blows, you know, showing the short circuit. And there was all, you know, at the start, a doubt in your mind, you know, whether you were going to, you know, it was going to work or perform. But I say this, throughout the war, I never remember having the slightest problem with the power trellis. No trouble at all, it actually worked perfect.